Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 153 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio exclusively right here on the listener-supported Head On Radio Network, also brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. Stop by CRMW.net, Coal River Mountain Watch, and see what mountaintop removal is doing to West Virginia. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Wednesday, June the 18th, 2008, and this is a special day. I have kept it very low-key, and we'll keep it low-key this evening, but just so that you know, Strictly Confidential has been airing exactly 1 year today. We started this show on June the 18th of 2007, and Mark Levine was our guest, and we had some remarkable audio clips from that show. And Mark came out to the listeners, those who did not know, on that particular show. And what a show it was. I remember I was so nervous that night, you could have knocked me over with a feather. I remember I actually almost typed the entire show word for word for fear that I wouldn't be able to make it through. But we did, and it was great fun, lots of interesting audio clips that night. So Strictly Confidential is 1 year old this evening, and if you're listening shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern Time on a Wednesday evening that is June the 18th, 2008, you are listening to a live show, and you're more than welcome to call and participate. It'll be a Just Us show tonight. You can chat with me about whatever topics are going on or whatever is on your mind. I'll be giving out the numbers in just a few minutes. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there you're going to find all of the links to the guests as well as to the audio archives of all the past shows and links there to the chat room. That's at strictlyconfidentialradio.com. The chat room is active this evening, and lots of animated campers are having a great time there. You'll find links at strictlyconfidentialradio.com for the MySpace page, and links to help you locate the music that you hear on the show. You'll also find there the Head On Radio Network main site link, where you can find out about all of the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network, as well as the PayPal buttons to make it easy for you to support the Head On Radio Network. And again, thank you, Coal River Mountain Watch, for your support also. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4, Head On. That translates into 877-443-2366 for you folks that are into the digits. If you have unlimited long distance, please use that. You'll save the studio a nickel or a buck. That is area code 304-658-3333. Rings in West Virginia. That's area code 304-658-3333. Mail is arriving to Peter at headonradionetwork.com. And so there are several ways to participate. You can email Peter at headonradionetwork.com, or you can use the toll or the toll-free line, or you can log into our chat room. And the chat room is easy to use. You just claim yourself a username, and it lets you go right in. There's no fees for that. And it's available 24 hours a day, and also during all of the live head-on radio network programming. What a wild week already. I had an issue. I'm not going to get into the story right now. I'm going to save that for the horn section this evening when John and myself, there's a special horn section this evening. I won't give you the surprise guest away, but it'll be myself and John and a surprise person on the horn section this evening. But I'm not going to get into the details of the story. I'll wait and tell that during the horn section. But there was a particular server issue or problem at the office that I installed a new server in. The likelihood of this happening to anybody is probably about as great as being snake bitten, hit by lightning, and winning the lottery all in the same day. It required many hours of phone calls and the whole bit, but finally it got resolved. So it's good, in fact, to be back. We missed the very first day of folks getting married in California, but we'll make up for that now. Roll it, Agnes.
Get married in the morning. Ding dong, the bells are gonna chime. Pull out the stopper, let's have a whopper. Get me to the church on time.
Yes, it started in San Francisco. It was a very quiet and also boisterous day, depending upon who and what you're looking at. The sense of history that permeated the air was significant, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of GLBT folks from all across California and indeed from other states began getting married Tuesday. And they are giving a human face to the court decision. And it's a very powerful opening salvo in what is expected to be a fall campaign that will not be nothing less than rabid and strident and difficult, because there are a lot of people who are upset with California's decision. The marriages there began just after 8 a.m. Pacific time with the opening of the county clerk's offices. It wasn't like 2004 when San Francisco broke the law to allow thousands of gay couples to get married. That was a mad rush, sort of like a sale at Macy's. But the ceremonies that started on Tuesday had a sense of calm, a sense of dignity, a sense of purpose, and a sense of permanence for the newly gay wed folks. Lori Franks, who's 43, says that back in the day when the gay marriage was allowed for that short period of time by the mayor, she said it was so legally ambiguous, but today it was really touching. This time it feels real. The Frank's wedding was one of about 19. It was held in one of 19 locations around San Francisco's city halls. And it was attended by her three daughters. They wore matching pink dresses and tiaras. Lori says it was entirely their idea, and as soon as they heard we were getting married, they said they wanted dresses. Over in Bakersfield, the couples exchanged vows on a patio outside the clerk's office, and reporters and photographers were crowded around, in fact, and sometimes outnumbering the people who were applying for messages or licenses. On Tuesday morning, there were no protesters in sight, however. We are so happy that we can't stop smiling, says Kathy Ghost, 52, who was wed to Karen Briefer, 45, in Bakersfield on Tuesday morning. The couple have been together for 11 years, and they plan to change their names to Briefer Ghost. Ms. Ghost says we have the same rights as any other American citizen, and that the weddings are a very slow cycle of equality for LGBT folks. The weddings actually started in a handful of locations around the state at exactly 5:01 p.m. on Monday. Now, that was the very earliest time that was allowed by the California Supreme Court. And all 58 counties were there to to participate. All 58 counties were authorized to begin the licenses on Tuesday. In San Francisco, Del Martin, who is 87, and Phyllis Lyon, who is 84. They're both longtime gay activists, and they were the first and only couple to be wed on Monday, saying that their vows in the offices of Mayor Gavin Newsom. And when they left the office, there was a throng of reporters and screaming well-wishers. The selection of Ms. Martin and Ms. Lyon was symbolic. San Francisco's first same-sex married couple. The couple was married there once before. That was in 2004 when the city issued the 4,000 marriage licenses and conducted weddings in City Hall in protest of the state laws. Those marriages were later invalid and kept invalid by the Supreme Court's decision. But on May 15, the court struck down the California laws that permitted the marriages and joined Massachusetts in the legalization of same-sex marriage. In Massachusetts, by the way, over 10,000 people have been married, 10,000 couples, which would be over 20,000 people have wed in Massachusetts. Of course, we know that same-sex marriage has been hotly contested by the religious right nationwide and at the state courts, at the ballot box. California is absolutely no exception. In fact, in November, the state's voters are going to decide whether to rescind the court's decision with a ballot measure that would define marriages between a man and a woman, in other words, enshrining discrimination into the Constitution. Many people are optimistic that that will not happen. It's fairly clear that it will be on the ballot. They do have enough signatures on their ballot measure, but it's beginning to look less and less likely that California will rescind that in November. Fortunately, Massachusetts is in a situation that I believe it's not until 2012 that it is possible for another war against gay marriage and to put it a constitutional ban against it. That's, you know, gay marriage is really a misnomer. It's really equal marriage. 44 states have some sort of a legal barrier, whether it's a constitutional amendment or a law. Florida is one of those states that bars any sort of union. In 2004 alone, 13 states passed ballot measures banning same-sex marriage. These heavy voter turnouts also voted for George W. Bush, and I certainly hope they're happy with the results of that. You know, there are times I have to admit a guilty pleasure. This is not something I recommend to you, but at times a guilty pleasure, a sort of smirk crosses my face when I realize and read in the news reports how desperately bad things are becoming in the United States. It's not funny, and it does not warrant a smile. The smile is strictly a smile of, well, how's that working out for you, for the people who asked, who actually pulled the levers for George W. Bush. I've said on the show before that were I king of the world, there would be a requirement for a written apology by every single registered Republican in the country before they would ever be allowed to vote again. I think that is the least, the absolute least that they could do. There's been some local opposition to the ceremonies in California, Kern County. It's a rural county. By and large, everything is going beautifully. But Kern County is north of L.A., and the county clerk has canceled all of the weddings, not just the same-sex weddings, but even the opposite-sex weddings performed by her office. Now, she took this position after consulting with the Alliance Defense Fund, read that right-wing rabid hate outfit. They are an Arizona organization that has its tentacles nationwide, well-funded, that argues against marriage for gay men and lesbians. And she said she's the supervisor of elections there in Kern County, that all of the weddings have been called off, even though in the county The clerk's office has long, long, long been an affordable sort of a no-frills option for couples. She says suddenly there is not enough budget or space to fight despite the fact there are at least three rooms dedicated for the ceremonies in the county clerk's office. But she realizes she's forced to issue the licenses, but she's not going to marry anyone anymore, even though there's space available. In the liberal parts of the state, which is quite a lot, the weddings are being very, very warmly embraced. And Contra Costa County, there's been a very steady stream of couples. And San Francisco, they descended on in the clerk's office on Tuesday. By noon, the officials had performed 12 of the 22 weddings that were scheduled by same-sex couples who were very anxious to tie the knot. The first to marry was a hometown son, Steve Weir. He's 59, and he's the county clerk recorder himself. And he married his longtime companion, John Hem, with more than 150 family and friends at the couple's ceremony. The vows were exchanged in a park in the county seat. He always said that if the state ever legalized same-sex marriage, he would be the first to wed and to issue his own license. That was the assistant county clerk reporter, Barbara Chambers, said that. She said, it was a little daunting to perform a ceremony for my boss, but I was excited, and I was a part of history. And Ms. Chambers says the other 13 weddings that have been scheduled for Wednesday, 9 for Thursday, and 20 for Friday are almost all same-sex couples, although there are a few heterosexual couples who are getting married also. She's had some people say that they absolutely did not want to get married during the very first week because they don't want to deal with the reporters and the craziness. They just want to finalize their commitment very quietly without the press. So, indeed, a lot of licenses have been issued, but the actual ceremonies have not taken place. They are all saying that they are going to schedule their weddings before November when the ballot will come up for the California voters to enshrine discrimination into the Constitution. One would hope that California does not do that. In fact, it's coming up in Florida in November, too. So both California and Florida will be a dirty little war coming up very soon. Ms. Chambers says that most of the people are very excited to be a part of this, but not all of the employees are. And she told them that it is non-negotiable. The job is to issue licenses, not judge the participants. There are reports of many other couples who have been together 8 years, 30 years, 14 years, 16 years, all of them getting married. And they're saying it feels great to be married. And some talk about the anxiety and the emotional stress of going through and living through the times when being married was not an option. One of the couples, Mr. Seymour, he's one of the folks getting married, says, we're as normal as everyone else and we deserve the right to marry. Now, marriage licenses in California used to refer to a bride and a groom. But now the wedding licenses, the forms call for Party A and Party B. Now, there's been discussion amongst folks as to who to put in Party A and Party B. Some are saying it should be in a heterosexual couple, the woman should be first because women are first. There's all sorts of different theories. But my personal theory on this is that Party A should be the person who asks. And Party B should be the person who accepted. But that's just my take on it. To make it even all more fun, it's not good news for the people who don't like gay folks this week. It's been a very bad week so far. Even in science, the gay men and straight women it's been found to share a lot of characteristics in the area of the brain that's responsible for emotion, mood, and anxiety. The researchers said this just a couple of days ago, highlighting the biological underpinnings of sexuality. And Their brain scans are showing that there's some symmetry among lesbians and straight men, and the observations can't be easily attributed to perception or to behavior, but what they relate to are probably processes laid down during the fetal or postnatal development. And brain scans of 90 volunteers showed that the brains of heterosexual men and homosexual women were slightly asymmetric, and that the right hemisphere slightly larger than the left, and the brains of gay men and heterosexual women were not. And there were all sorts of tests for blood flow into various parts of the brain, et cetera, et cetera. So the latest is they're going to be beginning tests at birth, immediately after birth, and then tracking these kids as they grow up to see if they turn out to be heterosexual or homosexual or somewhere in the middle, and that would eliminate the possibility of any sort of process outside the womb by studying children from birth. The couple that I mentioned a few moments ago, Del Martin, 87, and Phyllis Lyon, 83, have been together since 1952. That's longer than I've been born. These women have been together. They were the perfect choice for Monday's only marriage, and as I said, it was symbolic. The marriages for the rest started on Tuesday, but for Del and Phyllis, there was a single marriage at 5:01 p.m., the earliest possible time for a license in marriage to be placed in California. You see, in 1955, Del and Phyllis, along with six other women, founded the Daughters of Bilitis, and it was the first major lesbian organization in the United States. And Del was the group's president, and Phyllis edited the Daughters of Bilitis newsletter. It was called The Ladder. That's L-A-D-D-E-R. Well, Jim Burraway, the fellow that runs Box Turtle Bulletin, has been a guest in the show, has come across and has located a facsimile of the very first edition of The Ladder. It's from 1956, October of 1956, and it's a mimeograph. If those of you who might remember what a mimeograph is, and the newsletter includes an essay by Del Martin, one of the women who married. Del is 87, in which she explains why those women, founded the Daughters of Bilitis. It was an interesting essay. It provides us with a great perspective of the historic changes that these two women helped create. And for them to have been the first couple in California to marry after the court decision last Monday was highly appropriate, because many of us are enjoying the fruits from Del and Phyllis's hard work. I have a copy of that article that Del wrote in 1956 from The Ladder. This is a message from the president of Daughters of Bilitis. She says, since 1950, there has been a nationwide movement to bring understanding to and about the homosexual minority. Most of the organizations dedicated to this purpose come from the Mattachine Society, which was founded in L.A. at that time. And the members of those organizations, the Mattachine Society, one, and the National Association for Sexual Research, two, they're predominantly male, although there are a few hardworking women in these organizations. The Daughters of Bilitis is a women's organization resolved to add a feminine voice and viewpoint to this mutual problem. While many women may not have as much difficulty with law enforcement and their problems, their problems are nonetheless very real. Their problems include family, children, employment, and social acceptance. She says that lesbians are very elusive creatures. She, meaning lesbians, burrow underground in fear of identification. She is cautious in her associations and likely to go with current modes of hairstyle and casual attire to camouflage her existence. Reminds me of a line we had on the show several months back about how the world's going to hell in a handbasket, and suddenly there's millions of lesbians everywhere, and there never used to be lesbians. Well, here's the answer. They were in camouflage with beehive hairdos, sort of like the aliens were from Mars Attacks, I would guess, and probably just as uncomfortable. She claims that she does not need help, meaning Dell is writing in this article that lesbians who are camouflaging and hiding say that they do not need help. She will not risk her little fist of security to aid those who do, but surely the groundwork has been laid in the past 5.5 years. Homosexuality is not the dirty word it used to be. More and more people, professional and lay, are becoming aware of its meaning and implications. There is no longer much risk in becoming associated. And she says, and why not belong? Many heterosexuals do. Membership is open to anyone who is interested, meaning the Daughters of Elitis. In the minority is problems of sexual variant and does not necessarily indicate one's own sexual preference, which has been a huge stigma over the years. If you say you want to help, then you must be one of those people. Dell says women have been taking a beating throughout the centuries, and it's only been in this 20th century through the courageous crusades of the suffragettes and the influx of women into the world of business that women have become an independent entity, an individual with the right to vote and the right to a job and the right to an economically secure future. But it took women with foresight and determination to attain this heritage, which is now ours. Imagine this, written in 1952. And what will be the lot of the future lesbian? Fear? Scorn? It need not be. If lethargy is supplanted by an energized, constructive program, and if cowardice will give way to solidarity and the cooperative front. She says, if the let Georgia do it attitude is replaced by the realization of individual responsibility in thwarting the evils of ignorance, superstition, prejudice, and bigotry, things will change. Nothing has ever been accomplished by hiding in a dark corner. And how they wish we would go back. Why not discard the hermitage for the heritage that awaits any red-blooded American woman who dares claim it? And again, that was written by Del Martin, the president of Daughters of Belitis, back in 1952. And it is all these many decades later, all these many, many years later, all these many, many years of fighting and growing old together, you and me against the world, Del Martin, 87, and Phyllis Lyon, 83, married Monday in San Francisco. And the religious right wants to take it back and invalidate it in November. A sad day if that happens. The other marriage ceremonies that took place, there were people wearing everything from t-shirts to tuxedos and gowns. The untold hundreds of same-sex couples rushed to their county clerk's offices to obtain those marriage licenses and exchange vows. All 58 counties in California began issuing the licenses Tuesday. And even in San Diego, which is typically a Republican stronghold, they had to add 4 walk-up windows and assign 78 employees to issue marriage licenses. Imagine that, which was up from the usual 19 employees. It issued 230 licenses on Tuesday, and it broke the previous single-day record of 176 licenses on Valentine's Day of 2005. Now, in West Hollywood, City Hall, George Kai, who played Sulu on Star Trek, just beamed, if you'll pardon the pun. He just beamed as he and his partner of 21 years, imagine that, my partner's name is Brad, obtained one of the new gender-neutral Party A, Party B licenses, and they're planning their wedding for September, ahead of the November ballot. Zakai says, I see before me people who personify love, who personify commitment. And he flashed the Vulcan hand salute from Star Trek and said, may equality live long, and may equality prosper. There were very, very few demonstrations outside of some of the offices in the courts, courthouses, but they were by the folks who were seeking to have the ballot initiative come up in November. One of the demonstrators, only 16 years old, one wonders what sort of a family she grew up in, that it's not a time to be joyful. It's a time for us to pray about what's happening to this country. A 16-year-old, words out of her parents' mouth, book, chapter, and verse, as they would say. There are other conservatives who are saying that the activists shouldn't come on too strong because it could cause the initiative to fail in November if the conservatives come on too strong. Now, when you decode this, what he really means is that there's not enough people there to come on strong. You can be assured that if there were enough people there to riot and protest constantly, they would be there in full force. It seems that for many of them, equal marriage has become, the opponents for equal marriage has become harder and harder to come by. He says, oh, the major media, meaning the for-profit media, and here again there's this thing about the liberal media, which of course does not exist. He says, the major media would just love to see us engage in fierce protests and hostile demonstrations of outrage against the licensing same-sex marriages and sodomy. And again, you can be quite sure that if they had the people to do it, they indeed would be doing it right now. And, I think we should probably take a short break, and it's about 30 minutes into the program, and I'll give Agnes a clue here as to what that's going to be. There you go. And we'll be back in just a few minutes from the bottom hour of the first hour of Strictly Confidential. Again, the toll-free lines, 877, the number 4 head-on, or 877-443-2366, unlimited long distance. Use 304-658-3333.
For many years, churches all over the place have battled with the issue of sodomites. Recently, very many churches have ceased to strive for holiness, righteousness, and decency and obedience to God, and would rather ordain that which is abhorrent to God rather than resist it. And we now see the ordination of abomination in various outfits called churches all over the place, although there are no homosexuals in the church. A homosexual Christian is about the same as a Hindu Christian, a murderer Christian, a thief Christian, a liar Christian. You can't have a sinner Christian. It's a contradiction in terms. Christ came to save men out of sin, and as Brother John so ably put it, anyone who's born again of the Holy Spirit of God cannot sin. Those of you will know that's in the first letter of John. So talk about a gaze in the church is absolute nonsense.
When you meet a boy that you like a lot, and you fall in love, but he loves you not, and if a flame should start, you hold him near, better keep your heart. Keep it out of danger, dear. For the way of love is the way of woe, and the day may come
Think you know Senator John McCain? He likes to come off as a moderate, but his record on gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender issues promises that a President McCain will mean four more years of anti-gay policy in the White House. How about something as simple as a law that says you can't be fired from your job just because of who you are? In 1996, McCain didn't just vote against it. He was a deciding vote. How about making sure GLBT Americans are covered under federal hate crime laws? Senator McCain said no, three times.
Mr. McCain, no. Mr. McCain, no. Mr. McCain, no.
Surely Senator McCain would want to allow every capable man and woman to serve our country in the military. But he supports the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy that's fired 12,000 qualified servicemen and women. He voted against the federal marriage amendment, saying it should be up to the states to decide. But he's made it quite clear the way he wants them to decide.
I'm John McCain. Please join me in voting yes on Proposition 107.
That position and his vote for the Defense of Marriage Act puts him against marriage equality, civil unions, and domestic partnerships, as well as federal benefits. And he's against allowing same-sex couples to adopt. A president's influence reaches much further than his term through the judges he appoints. So who are McCain's model judges? Just like George Bush, he's promised the right wing more justices like Samuel Alito. On HIV and AIDS issues, Senator McCain voted for a Jesse Helms strategy to cut prevention funding aimed at the gay community, and he also voted to bar people with HIV from immigrating to the United States. So, does John McCain sound like a moderate to you? He actually sounds pretty familiar. Get involved in the election at hrc.org.
And there you have the public service announcement from the Human Rights Campaign, produced at great expense, directed to the Log Closet Republicans. Log Closet Republicans, by the way, are slow LGBT people, republitards, if you wish, and we have our quota of them, too. So at great expense, we very, very slowly and clearly explained to the Log Closet Republicans, well, the facts of the situation. Took 2 full minutes. It would take some time to get through to these people. It's almost embarrassing that we have people like that. But they're our own Uncle Toms. The LGBT version of an Uncle Tom is indeed a Log Closet Republican. And that PSA was for you. You know, shortly before this show started this evening, I got a phone call from our executive director of talent bookings, Mr. Glenn Rivera, and you could have bowled me over with a feather. He called to tell me that Jessica Williams, yes, that is the Jessica Williams, you may know her by her hit Queen of Fools, will be on the show this coming week. Now, we haven't decided whether it's going to be Tuesday or Wednesday. That's still up the air, but again, this is one of the huge disco divas from the day of whom I used to play her records. And, of course, this always makes me terribly, terribly nervous. I could talk to the mayors and the bishops and all of that with no problems. But, boy, if I get somebody on the show whose records I used to play, I'm sort of meltdown. So, in any case, we'll be sending out an announcement to our music groups regarding Jessica Williams, and I simply cannot wait to talk to her. What a career she has achieved. What a delightful, delightful woman is Jessica Williams. had a request from the chat room this evening before the show started for another artist. Nightlife Lady. Who was Nightlife Lady? Yellow. Well, no, she'll tell me in a moment. I love the nightlife, love the boogie. Can't remember her name. I am getting old. But in any case, a request to have her on the show. Boy, that would be cool. I'll have to mention to Mr. Glenn Rivera when I talk to him again that we would love to have Nightlife Boogie on the show, and I'm terribly embarrassed. Thank you, Elo. Alicia Bridges. And I've played her music, too, and I'm awfully embarrassed. I couldn't call her name, but... you know, when you get 55 and you've done all the and you've been doing the homosexual agenda for a number of years, you get a little bit off kilter. But that's a great idea, ELO, and we'll have to see if we can do that. Also, I want to tell you that next week we're actually having two music guests. Next week we'll have singer-songwriter Don Harvey on. Now, Don Harvey is part of Gay Guitarists Worldwide. And indeed, his style of music is what you might be called LGBT folk. And it will be an interesting interview. He will be next week also. Tomorrow night, our music guest for this week is John Hedges. And he's a producer and a veteran DJ and the founding owner and operator of Megatone Records, which was the brand back in the day. And I'm looking forward to talking to John Hedges. John Hedges also comes to us by way of Mr. Glenn Rivera, the executive director of talent bookings here on the Hedo Radio Network, and what would I do without him? I'm looking at a very interesting open letter. It's addressed to the newlyweds in California. It's a letter of congratulations, and it is from a transsexual. Very interesting perspective, and I'm going to share some of it with you. So first of all, says, let me offer my congratulations. It's been far too long in coming, and I hope you will indulge me by letting me take a moment to note that it was a trans man who led the attorneys and who indeed was the lead attorney in the marriage equality case. It was the one who made the oral arguments to the California Supreme Court that marriage wouldn't be worth any less if everyone could take part in it. And what an attractive man he was. I remember watching some of those hearings, and I thought to myself, wow, he's a cute lawyer. And as it turns out, he's a trans man. He was the lead attorney. Yeah, more importantly, this person is saying, I'd like to ask you to remember Shannon and his dedication to this cause when ENDA comes up for a vote in Congress again, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. And again, the contrast here is the large number of LGBT folks, the largest number, are what the writer calls virtually normal. That's a quote. Now, virtually normal means that you fill your gender role in a way that is not threatening to the earth people. In other words, women act like women up to a certain point, and men should act like men up to the boundaries of what they consider their comfort zones. And indeed, it was the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. Its failure had to do strictly with the fact that they just want the LGBT folks who can pass, who won't be too much of a problem, to have employment security, and that we can indeed get rid of the bull dykes and the queens should they be in our employ. But as long as you act the part, you'd be fine. What upsets this person, and it upset me at the time, is that they were excluded because supposedly. And Barney Frank actually said the words that, you know, that they hadn't heard from any trans people, that the reason they were letting, you know, dropping that particular, the T of our rainbow, was because they hadn't done jack blank to deserve any anti-discrimination protection because they just weren't present. Well, the writer of this letter points out that trans people have been a part of LGBT communities and fighting for LGBT rights for decades. Now, there's an author of a book called Gay LA, and there's a note that we chose to call our book Gay LA because it's our older information from the our seniors, our senior gay people, that the word gay back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and even into the 60s was a term that included homosexual men and lesbians and transgenders and even bisexuals, and it wasn't until after that period of time that the word gay began to refer to a specific group, and the other groups broke out with their own words. How handy it must have been at the time to be able to use one word to describe us all. The history goes back further than that. Can you believe 1895? Yes, that's 1895. The transsexual who writes this letter says a group of New York androgynes, or androgynes, meaning androgynous, organized what was called the Hermaphrodites. Not hermaphrodites, it's spelled differently. I'm not equal to pronouncing some of this. Hermaphroditos, that's it, Hermaphroditos. And it was to unite against the world's persecution. And this was 2 years before the world's first gay liberation organization and nearly 30 years before the first known gay activist group in the United States and nearly six decades before the first long-lasting gay and lesbian rights group. What an interesting detail that I, and I suppose many of us, did not know that the documenting the movement back to as far as 1895, it was the trans folks. It's funny how the people who are kicked the hardest will fight back first. She points out also that in the 60s, a trans man, that was a multimillionaire, Reed Erickson, was a major funder. He spent almost $2 million, which is worth, I think, about $1 billion in today's dollars, to form an outfit called One, and it was one of the first gay rights organizations and won a landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision. It was in 65 in the Philadelphia, at the lunch counter of Dewey's, that was the target of an LGBT sit-in after the diner refused to serve young gay and trans patrons who were euphemistically called non-conforming and non-conforming because they're wearing non-conforming clothing. This is really the essence of the situation. You have to act your gender role in this society. It's got to do with the enforcement of femininity, what the roles for women are, what the roles of men are, and boy, you better not cross those lines. In 1966, a trans woman who was fed up with the police harassment and turned into what was then called Screaming Queens and rioted at the Compton cafeteria in San Francisco. And it was in 1969 that a trans woman who is a drag queen, Sylvia Rivera, threw the first bottle at the Stonewall riots and later was a tireless advocate for LGBT rights. The involvement of the trans community in this struggle has been, well, far, far more than any of us know or will even admit. And for us to leave them behind so easily with the LG from the EMDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, for us to drop them so blithely and saying, "Oh, we'll come back for you later," is insulting, and I think a disgusting move and part of the LGBT community. Now, to the community's defense, there were something like 300 organizations, gay rights organizations, wrote to Congress when they removed the trans from the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, saying, no, do not do this, but nonetheless they removed it anyway. And this is in spite of knowing it was going to be vetoed anyway, so why not include the trans? The damn bill was going to be vetoed anyway. What freaking difference did it make if our trans brothers and sisters were in part of this bill? Now, in any case, there's more to tell about that story, and I'll tell you some more in a moment. But right now we have Preston on the line, and we don't want to keep Preston waiting. Preston is our listener from Denver. We're always glad to have him on the show. Hiya, Preston.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm doing okay for an old guy, Preston. How are you this evening?
I'm doing all right. Doing okay. Like you, I'm happy to see all these gay marriages taking place. And despite the warnings from the right wing, California hasn't fallen into the sea yet.
Oh, you know, the first hurricane, or rather earthquake is what they have there. I'm so used to hurricanes being the disaster because I grew up in Florida. But the first earthquake, you know what's coming.
They'll be playing for it for sure.
Absolutely. We'll have to break out our track. We call it Earthquake. We have a song we sometimes play here called Earthquake. We'll have to run that song that day.
Well, what else? I love the story you told, Del Martin, in her words about lethargy giving way to effort or something like that, and cowardice giving way to solidarity.
Yeah, yeah, her words were really something. You know, back in the day, these people fought very, very hard. And I'm looking for it now, there was the last word she said was to move from, I can't locate it right now, but it was a wonderful statement regarding moving between two different perceptions. It was part of that we ran at the time. Here it is. To move from hermitage to heritage. I thought, wow, that's a great line, lady. I like hermitage to heritage. Yeah, you could have said it better. The bottom of my stack, I had to find it.
We have, here in Denver, we have our big gay pride celebrations coming up. Just a few blocks from where I live, actually. Kicks off in this place called Cheeseman Park. Beautiful spot here in the middle of an old part of Denver. And they're expecting like 200,000 people. We get a lot of people come in from all these rural towns in, you know, the Front Range of Colorado and from Wyoming and little towns.
Now that's got to be an interesting gay pride. You expect lots of cowboys and non-traditional roles coming from these these little rural areas of Montana. I mean, there's nothing much there to do but be a rancher or a horse rancher. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're right. You're right. I think Wyoming only has it's a sparsely populated state for how huge it is. And, ranching's big. I'm sure they've got some military installations, too. There is a university town there, you know, Laramie, infamous.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, yeah. Sure.
It's a great town, by the way. I've been up there a couple times. And by and large, you know, there, you can feel a lot more progressive energy to that town.
And, yeah, university towns are often can swing things in that way, of course, unless, of course, it's the Oral Roberts University or the Jerry Falwell's. What was it? I forget the name of his particular school, but it's really irrelevant. But 200,000 people, Preston, now that's what you call a turnout.
It is. It is. And they've been getting numbers like that for a few years now. And it will be fun. I know I work with an open lesbian woman, and in my apartment building right here, I have a young male couple just below me. And recently I learned one of them went to a Pride Fest in Mexico City about a year or so ago. His dad's from Mexico, and he and his dad had spoken for a long time about, you know, visiting their roots together, but they had never quite gotten around to it, and he said, you know, I'm just going to check this out myself. And he went with a friend of his during Pride Fest, and he absolutely loved it. And he got all the warnings, you know, that you get before you go, you know, there something might happen, don't go out after dark. And
yeah. Well, he has a good point.
Yeah, and you never know. But that's true on anything. You know, every time we get in our car, you never know. And he ended up enjoying it so much, he spent the entire 2 weeks in Mexico City and roaming all around and, you know, being openly feminine. And he's got these big earrings, that kind that you kind of put inside the lobe, and your lobe kind of gets bigger. And
oh, my stars.
Yeah, and people were fascinated by it. Like, kids would, like, want their picture taken with them, and people would ask him how much his earrings cost and if he had extra and all this thing. And and he was telling me, you know, they've got conjugal visits between gay lovers in some of their prisons. And I was like, wow. I'd read something about that. You know, some of their prisons, I'm sure, are hideous places, but there are these some prisons that have these very liberal policies.
Yeah, there are. I remember mentioning that a while back. It wasn't a story about it, but it was part of another story that the Christian right was very upset with the idea of equal marriage, because of the fact that that would give LGBT prisoners more rights than the heterosexual prisoners, because. And how did it work? Because the LGBT folks could find partners and fall in love in prison and in fact, live together all the time, whereas the heterosexual prisoners could only have, are never housed with the women, so they could only have their wife come in from the outside, and that this was in some way, I don't know, if you've ever been in prison, there's not a whole lot of love there. There's aggression, and
yeah.
I haven't been in prison, but I thought it was an interesting take on the whole situation that was one of the things they were outraged about. And in any other conversation, they would be they wouldn't give a damn about prisoners or what they're able to do or what their privileges are. You know, lock them up and throw away the key is the usual that you hear from there. For them to drag that out just blew me away.
Yeah, I haven't been in prison either, but you know, some friends of mine have. And, it's often been traumatizing. But oftentimes, you know, depending on which prison they were at, sometimes it was just very educational. Actually, my nephew was arrested for a DWI in Arizona, and he ended up spending a few days in this kind of famous Maricopa County prison in Arizona.
Wow, that's a rough place. They put the people in tents out in the desert heat and served them green bologna that's about to rot.
That's right. That's right. And this is an extremely different situation than what he's accustomed to. But he said it was interesting. Another friend of mine who was doing a weekend stint at a prison in, I think, in Longmont or Boulder, he also was like, it blew him away, some of the people who were spending longer amounts of time there. I mean, there were some rough people, but more often than not, it was like people who were in jail for, like, stealing a chicken from the processing plant they worked at.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, food.
Yes. Yeah. And so many people who are actually in county jails, in the city jails, however it's managed, are actually not convicted of a crime at all. They're just arrested and don't have the money for bail. And in fact, many people who are innocent are held in some pretty brutal circumstances. Well, you know, compared to Gitmo, not brutal. But by the same token, though, in the innocent until proven guilty society that we live in, it just ain't right.
That's right. You know, the resources make so much of a difference, how you're treated in the system. That's for sure. You know, actually, I wanted to mention something about what kind of response we're going to see to the gay marriage movement. You know, you can see them kind of gearing up, and they've already been protesting and that sort of thing. But I came across something kind of hopeful. I was reading a book review in Mother Jones Magazine, and the book is called The Fall of the Evangelical Nation, The Surprising Crisis Inside the Church. Yeah, it talks about, and it's written by someone who is part of it, who's an evangelical herself, and, you know, she gets something else out of it. She's not anti-gay, and she's not of that part of that movement. You know, she gets a lot out of the mythology, and, you know, there are these parts of the evangelical movement that are interested in things like the poor and AIDS in the world and the environment. And so the point of this book is that it's not as big as our perception of it is, in a way. And even the numbers that we get from, like, the Pew Institute has made these estimates of, they said something like 54 million people are evangelical Protestants. Well, this woman for this book looked at those numbers and found that they're hugely inflated. They include people who have been double or triple counted. It includes perennial no-shows. You know, people don't go to the church very often. It includes people who have converted to other faiths. And,
who've left it altogether, that they would ever drop you. You can leave a church and still remain a member to infinity.
Yep. And she used these memos, actually, from, like, the Southern Baptist Convention. And, you know, the organization claimed 16 million members, but one of the reverends inside the Baptist Convention says they couldn't find half of them. You know, they're not really there. It's a problematic force, definitely, but I think it's important to kind of think maybe, you know, it's not as big as it seems. And I think it gets a big profile by their political allies who can use them, you know, to, they claim to be a moral majority, but they're this moral fringe group, a radical fringe group. Doesn't have that same ring to it, you know. You know, they're always trying to label us as the fringe radicals, but more and more, a lot of it's just they're trying to drive a particular perception. You put us into the hermitage, you know, put us, you know, into the margins when they're the ones that are really out of the mainstream.
And I'm so glad you're bringing these things up, Preston. And it goes to the heart of this whole problem with the for-profit media. It's going to get a lot more people talking about, you know, the missing blonde girl in Aruba and the people who are screaming about the dangers of the homosexual snapping up your children rather than to have a mainstream pastor or a mainstream, the majority, so to speak, talking about the love of Christ and radical inclusion. Now, that doesn't play well on the evening news because it hasn't got that knockdown, drag-out, you know, video game flavor to it. It's a damn shame. And, yes, we've all been duped. There's no majority there. Even I can see in my little Methodist church that I go to out here in the middle of nowhere, just a half mile down from the dirt road. It's a very small, it's a little historic church. It's like one large room. It's on the national, it goes back a long, long way in the community. Now, there's a handful of people there who really, you know, just soon the LGBT folks fall off the edge of the planet, but by and large, the majority does not feel that way. And it has always been this way. And where in the hell did the moral majority come from? It's a made up phenomenon. And God, the price we've paid for it.
Yeah. Yeah. They, you know, they get these resources and publicity from these elements that need a divided populace, you know, so it's more easily controlled. And, you know, I've actually heard at times them kind of reveal this, like some of their media operatives, William Crystal and Jonah Goldberg and these other figures, they every once in a while they'll mention how they are an elite and they see themselves as like special ops forces, who can operate in such a manner that even though they're very few in number, they can accomplish a lot. I heard a college Republican say that on the radio. The guy was interviewing him, and he said, you know, don't you feel outnumbered at this liberal university that you're at? And the guy's like, well, you know, there aren't many of us, but, you know, we work in such a way that we have a huge impact. And I think the way in which they work, again, is a lot of support from their moneyed allies and a lot of support in the media. I mean, this person was being interviewed on some big AM talk station, and, you know, they've got people like David Horowitz and others who are, you know, helping, assisting them with their media work and networking and learning how to do politics effectively, even though they are few in number. And, boy, if you know, the real majority of this country kind of begins just minimal things regarding networking and solidarity and overcoming their lethargy and their fears, that would be the real change for sure. And it seems to be...
Go ahead.
Sorry?
Please go ahead. It seems to be...
I see it manifesting, certainly, here and there. I mean, just before I got on the phone with you, I was watching this program, this channel called Current TV, and it is so different from what we've been subjected to for so long. It's multicultural. It's gay-friendly. It's curious about other countries in the world. It's
wow.
It's serious. This little segment, it's made by the viewers. I mean, it totally, like, flips the paradigm. Instead of executives at General Electric, you know, guiding a media demigod, it's people, viewers, who send in their own 3 or 5 minute long video stories about a whole wide variety of things. And the one I was just watching was little video news story called The Duke of Herb, or Duke of Herbs, and he's this the shaman, American guy, or U.S. citizen, who moved down to South America, became this world-renowned plant biologist, and learned all these traditional medicines and uses of different plants, and he's a big critic of the pharmaceutical companies, and, you know, he's like, some of these drugs they use and people get, and they get all these terrible side effects. You know, we've got this whole closet of pharmacy right here in these plants, and usually without these side effects. And a fascinating guy. He's a big advocate for protecting the rainforest. And I'm watching this and I'm thinking, boy, the people keep a lid on this must be not enjoying this very much, but it seems to be a wildly popular show.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that many of the things that you brought up. Now, I've not seen this. I assume it's cable television programming.
Well, I have satellite dish, DirecTV.
Yeah.
So it's satellite, and I guess it's on some. I imagine it. I don't know if that means it's on cable too, but or if it could just be a satellite thing. I don't know. Maybe it's on cable too.
Well, it's about time. I heard a remark a couple of weeks ago it may be an old line, but I've never heard it before. I just thought it was the funniest thing I'd ever heard. You mentioned that the program was actually, I believe your words were, is actually interested in other countries, and it reminds me of how poor the educational system is. And in fact, the remark that I heard was that war is God's way of teaching us geography. And you know, and it's so true. We don't know where anything is unless it's suddenly in the news. And a war has broken out. And you were talking too about the fellow who was in the church who said in the university who was asked how do you stand to be here amongst all these liberals? He says, well, there's not very many of us, but we're very, very effective. Mm-hmm. And that's a very great line. And It stems back to the IRD, the Institute on Religion and Democracy, which is, as you were saying, very well funded by what is it, the Richard Mellon family, and what is it, Mellonscape, or the Mellons, the Carnegie Mellons, and in any case, they actually have various employees who are devoted to certain religions to infiltrate them and break them down and cause divisions. Now, the guy that's assigned to the Methodist Church is Mark Tooley, and he's a former CIA black ops guy, and so much of this is under the radar, and so much of this mess that we're in is stirred up by the people in power, because by keeping the churches broken apart and all of the, you know, you can never focus on what the real issue is. You always fall for the same old tricks every time. Look this way. Don't look there. Look over here. Look over here. This is the problem. And so this program, it sounds to me as if it's a step in the right direction.
It is. They have a couple correspondents that are constantly, going to, China or Vietnam or Lebanon, and if we do learn about a country, it's almost always how is it allegedly some threat to Western civilization,
I know it. I know it. It is so absurd how backward we are. We somehow got the impression that because we came over and stole the country from the Native Americans that we can forget the rest of the world, that we have found a little island. But in reality, it's not that way at all. I'm terribly embarrassed by a lot of the activity and we're the laughingstock in so many ways.
Yeah, and that's one of those perception trickeries that they pull on us by constantly speaking in terms of how threatened we are. We're able to divert from our consciousness the massive, much more real threat we are to these other nations, to Iran and to Venezuela, to Iraq. They've got long histories, of being concerned about what we're up to, But if we can keep talking about, they're developing WMDs, or their leaders done some bad things, we can, again, it's that kind of misperception or misdirection of our attention they do. It's like we're always talking about their terrorist training camps, and for months and months and months and months, we saw that image, that slow-mo of the guys kind of in the black pajamas swinging from the monkey bars.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that image?
Yes, it gets great. Yes, over and over and over. And eventually it's true.
Yep. And we never, there isn't that slow-mo at our terrorist training camps like at the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia.
And well they're said.
They're doing much more effectively destructive things and the monkey bar exercise. I mean, they're reading up on the CIA torture manuals and learning how to operate all kinds of big guns, for sure. And that's always, again, they frame it as, well, that's defense, always. Never mind that we've overthrown their leaders and stuff like that. But it seems
right.
The other side is always, they're hoping for some incident. I mean, if we continue on this kind of militaristic path, they may, it's kind of like in Israel and the occupied territories. Oftentimes the Israeli hawks, they can't stand it if a Palestinian militant group is abiding by a truce, because it removes their pretext for attacks. And sometimes the Palestinians go for weeks and weeks and weeks abiding by truces, and Israel will purposely try to provoke them with all sorts of attacks and artillery shells, and then finally when they get the, some cobbled together rocket makes its way across the border, Israel can go, see, they're trying to throw us into the sea. Guess we've got to respond.
Yeah, Bob Kincaid the other evening was pointed out something that I think all of us secretly think in the back of our minds, but I hadn't heard anyone actually say it before. Pointed out that the current administration is praying night and day that there will be some sort of attack on the U.S. And you know that it would solve so many. And one wonders if they won't just hire or program the ops people to just pull one off while wearing the appropriate clothing, et cetera, et cetera. I wouldn't put anything past them.
Nor would I. I think even Rumsfeld said something along the lines of, they're losing their brand, the Republican brand was losing popularity, and he said something like, well, they'll come back to us when we get hit again.
I hadn't heard that, but yeah, that's exactly the undercurrent. That's exactly what it is. And because we are no safer, because the ports are still no safer, because of so many things, Preston, it is more likely now than ever before that their dream will come true.
And yeah, because we haven't taken those, checking the cargo and stuff like that. And at the same time, because we continue with our own massive aggression in the world. It's amazing to me that we don't get more blowback. I mean, no Guatemalans ever came up here and blew something up, even though we had been sponsoring these dictators who were committing genocide on the Mayan Indians there. We never had a Vietnamese person come here and say, you killed 3 million people in our country with your B-52s, and you burned us alive with napalm, and you poisoned our country with Agent Orange, 20 million gallons of that crap, and we still have kids being born deformed because of it. We're going to get a little payback. They never did that, ever. And we can go there. It amazes me that we can go there, veterans can go there, and be welcomed by them.
Wow, that's an interesting perspective. It hadn't occurred to me before. I always think of the napalm, involving Vietnam, but it hadn't. But you've really driven it home for me about what's happened there also.
Yeah, Vietnam and Cambodia, they still lose a couple dozen people a month to unexploded ordnance that we left behind. Maybe cluster bomblets or whatever that a farmer might hit with a plow, or a kid might pick it up out of curiosity. And they've asked several times for maps of where we did some of the bombing, and we refused, say it's some kind of security issue, and sorry, you'll find them when you hit them, basically. And they teach their young kids through like songs in elementary school about, don't pick up the shiny metal object and things like that.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
Well, just recently there was a report of several of the modern industrialized countries. If I'm not mistaken, I don't have the article in front of me, but if I'm not mistaken, Japan was one of them who signed on to it to ban the use of cluster bombs. And, of course, glaringly absent from any signatures on that is the United States.
Yeah, us and China and Russia, I think one or
two. Yeah, Russia. That's right. That's right. Russia was in that group, too. It amazes me where we've descended to. We are indeed becoming the country of aggression. And we're all so dumbed down to it. The for-profit media, what can I tell you?
Yeah, it's interesting. I got to Alan Colmes's book, Red, White, and Liberal, recently. And I must say, I was kind of prejudiced, speaking of kind of misperceptions that we can develop. I read a lot of left-wing media criticism and stuff, and Alan Colmes is often dismissed as kind of being Sean Hannity's punching bag kind of thing, and I kind of accepted that. And I guess there might even be elements of truth to it, I don't know, but generally speaking, well, they started airing his show on the progressive talk show station here, and I was like, wait a minute, this guy actually is doing a lot of great work. And on his show, he'll take on these generals, he'll take on Newt Gingrich, and his radio show, he just gets deluged with these calls from these Hannitized
that's a great word. Yeah,
It's one that they're proud of. I mean, that's a, they call themselves. Hey, they'll call Sean and be like, "Oh, I've been anatized." You know.
Oh, I see. I know the Limbaugh Ditto bit, but I didn't know that.
It's exactly that equivalent, and you know, they're part of the club, and Alan gets these calls just relentlessly from these people, and his patience with them. He gets tired of it. And pissed off at times, and he has great arguments, counter arguments. Sometimes he gets so fed up. I've actually heard him once that some evenings go, you know, after about the 12th right wing lunatic, he'll be like, "Are any normal people going to call tonight?" It kind of gets me frustrated with the liberal community, because I'm like, you know, if some of the left wingers who like are so quick to criticize him were actually, you know, they can have their criticisms of him, but, you know, they could take part in this forum. There's no reason why these right-wingers should dominate it. I've called in a couple times. I get on and say a few words, and, you know. And, but anyway, where was I going with that? Alan Collins, in his book, Red, White, and Liberal, he actually quotes Noam Chomsky a couple of times in his book. And he left one of his chapters with a Chomsky quote, something about the astounding obedience of much of our media commentary. And there's another line from him where he says, the United States is the leading terrorist nation in the world. And I was like, good for Alan. You know, he's quoting this guy using this very radical thought. And he is still able. He is such a diplomatic, kind of affable guy, that this book, he's able to get blurbs on the back of it from people as diverse as, you know, I forget the progressive people who are blurbing it, but Newt Gingrich blurbed his book, which quotes Noam Chomsky. I mean, that's a feat, I think, of like kind of interpersonal accommodation or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And what great news is anyone but, being quoted, that's a definite step in the right direction. Absolutely true. And that we've been dumbed down so much. We've been taught that we cannot change anything. We were talking about the fact that people from the left don't call in, or they know better, but they don't participate. They don't write letters to the editor. They don't make phone calls. They just sort of sit back and know that things are wrong. I tend to blame that on the for-profit media. We have been carefully taught that we are powerless, and it's we've been neutered in a sense. If you'll pardon the masculine reference, that we have no power, and people learn that lesson very quickly and become complacent and just get herded around. Damn shame.
A fantastic author and kind of thinker on these issues, Frances Moore LePay, she writes about what she calls living democracy. And she has this analysis of what she calls these thought traps that are laid out for us. Yeah.
Great phrase.
Yeah, And she has a whole list of them, and it's like, yep, I know that. I know that one. I've been in that one a few times. And
well, wow, now who is this again? Who's this is terribly fascinating to me. I love things like who wrote this and what's the name of the book again?
She's one of our great heroines of our day. Her name's Frances Moore LePay, and she first got recognition for a book called Diet for a Small Planet. And she wrote that about 20 years ago, and it's been translated into like 20 different languages and sold hundreds and hundreds of thousands of copies. And part of the premise of her book is that enough food is being produced in the world. The issue is how it's being distributed or not being distributed, and also, you know, how this food's often being kind of misused in a way. Like, she argues how even closer, more two-thirds of the world has been traditionally vegetarian or nearly vegetarian, but the meat industry has been kind of pushing its, you know, quarter pound, two times a day diets on the rest of the world, you know, to feed all these cows it takes more grain, and it's a very inefficient use of grain. And they're opening these like mega meat processing plants for, with subsidies from the World Bank, and it's creating food shortages in the world. This has been going on for a while. You know, it's not just with ethanol production. I think in some ways, you know, there are all sorts of ways we're misusing grain. But anyway, she argues how we need you know, just more fairness and justice in our food distribution systems. And and anyway, she talks a lot about democracy. Some of her more recent books, I think one's called Getting a Grip, and it's about reviving democracy in the U.S. And another, one of her books I loved, it's called, I think it's Hope's Edge. Hope's Edge. And it's like stories of from people around the world here in the U.S. and other countries who have, you know, been parts of movements, like the Green Belt Movement in Africa. She met one guard, Thai, this Kenyan woman who won the Nobel Peace Prize, and she's part of this Green Belt Movement that's planted like 1.5 million trees or more in Kenya over the past decade or so, fruit trees and shade trees and trees that prevent soil erosion. And she, you know, you'd think that was a, would be a popular project, but she was getting beaten by these government officials who were, you know, didn't like to see this popular movement gaining ground and claiming land, and but she kept at it and kept at it, and it was beautiful. And she won the Nobel Peace Prize like 4 years ago. I think she was the first, one of the first Africans, and I think the first African woman to receive it. You know, I remember the next day, Dennis Prager, one of these right-wing hosts on the Salem radio network, you know, tried dissing her because she had dared to say something about how she made a comment at one point about how AIDS might be, may have been something cooked up in some laboratory and, you know, to decimate the African population. And he, you know, that's all he gave of her. You know, again, it's that trick. If you're going to say something that's either negative or that can be in some way, you know, people can kind of try to ridicule her. Don't give any context.
Right, to make you seem foolish, right.
Yeah. Don't give any context for that remark, like, you know, Tuskegee Institute experiments and all
sorts. Yeah, no history, right.
Right.
Well said. Wow, that's fascinating. I just don't know this person. I'm wondering, did she also bring into play this thing about patented seeds? You talked about the fair distribution of food, and that seems that would tie into it. The fact that we're trying to give copyrights to corn.
You know, in her first book, Diet for a Small Planet, I think it was written before the genetically modified organisms were really coming into being. But I believe she does talk about that stuff in some of her more recent writings. Yeah, speaking of getting to know the world better, she and her daughter, Anna, founded this organization called the Small Planet Institute, and they touch on all these issues of food security issues, for sure. The big one in women's rights. So her daughter's an activist as well, and so is her son, who does, his name is, I forget his name, but he's involved with this media project called the Guerrilla News Network.
Yes, and that I've heard of, yes.
Which I think in some ways was kind of a, you know, kind of a predecessor of current TV. It's people doing smaller video news stories and kind of an indie media type effort. Most recently, her son was part of the team that created a graphic novel, you know, kind of like a cartoon.
Yeah.
And it's called War Stories, and it's kind of like this futuristic dystopian vision of, you know, U.S. military empire charging along into the future. And in this graphic novel, which came out about 2 years ago, the future president of the United States happens to be John McCain.
Oh, my God.
I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah. One wonders how many psychological twists he has after being a hell captive and the things he went through being mistreated. One wonders how much of a George Bush syndrome of I'm going to get Saddam because he tried to kill my daddy thing that McCain has going on in his head about other countries and what he went through.
I want to get these people because, you know, the way they treated me or they treated people he knew, you know. But, again, it's that huge blind spot. This is a good example of that blind spot, us seeing clearly, you know, our own, pain and suffering. But how often do we consider the pain and suffering he inflicted from 10,000 feet in the sky, dropping bombs on villages?
Yes.
You cannot discuss that. It's like heresy. You can only, if you're going to talk about him in Vietnam, you're going to use the words hero and service to the country.
Yeah,
you're not
that's
going to talk
that
about.
Way.
You can't talk about state terrorism.
Yeah, or the fact that the war was contrived altogether, just like this one.
Yep. Yep. That's right.
Well, Preston, you again, you are always fascinating. Now, we always talk about a movie, so you can't go without the story that I was going to talking about the trans person who wrote the congratulations letter to about getting about equal marriages and pointing out the large number of trans folks who have been involved in the movement since the very beginning, including the attorney that actually argued the case in front of the Supreme Court. She mentions in her article about the 1999 murder of Private First Class Barry Winchell, and of course he was killed because he wasn't killed for being gay. You see, it's kind of a situation where it's inconvenient. It's an inconvenient truth that he wasn't killed for being gay. He was killed because he was a heterosexual man in love with a trans woman, which made the killers assume that made him gay. Anyway, the movie is Soldier's Girl. Remarkable movie. Have you seen it?
I've heard of that, Soldier's Girl.
It's about Winchell. It's a well-done movie. It's not your standard documentary with fact and graphs and charts and all that sort of thing. It's actually a well-done story of how he was treated in his barracks and their personal relationship in the little mobile home, little house trailer in the middle of nowhere. You know, it was very touching. It really broke my heart. But it's a movie called Soldier's Girl, and I'm not sure exactly when it came out, but I believe that was in 1999. When was that happened to that man? Well, that was, Lord, I don't remember. But, anyway, I wanted to tell you about Soldier's Girl. If you haven't seen it, it's a great movie, and for the listeners, too.
I've got my Amazon page up right now. And
I'll check out the internet.
I'll check Netflix, too.
I probably got it from there. I think I got it from there, and I think the full title is Soldier's Girl. And there's more to it, a story of, in any case, you'll know, it'll mention PFC Barry Winchell in the text, in the description of, if you just, there can't be that many movies called Soldier's Girls. You'll find that.
I see it right now. It's there. Came out in 2003 here. Something like
that. That sounds about right. It was around 99 that happened. It wasn't very long ago in dog years.
It's got a lot of very positive reviews, 70 customer reviews, and it has a 4.5 star out of 5 rating, which is quite high.
Yeah, you'll like that. I'm sure you will. In fact, I'd like to see it again. I've only seen it once, and it was years ago, and this article I was covering brought it to memory. It jogged my mind as to what a wonderful... And the writer of the letter points out, and this has to do with the gender roles, how we're assigned to certain gender roles, and you better not cross any lines. And so he wasn't killed because he was gay; it's because he was in love with a trans woman. So you know these things, And it's wonderful to hear different perspectives from different communities. That's something that I treasure about getting having the opportunity to do a show like this.
At times like this, when I find a movie like this, Soldier's Girl, I wish I was still doing that Books for Soldiers project. And I was it makes people could send books and DVDs and music to U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Oh,
other
were you involved in that?
Empire.
Yeah.
I did that for about a year and a half, and frankly, when I went into it, I was wondering if I was kind of going to get away with what I had in mind, because I saw them, they were getting deluged with a lot of right-wing stuff, Sean Hannity books and DVDs and all these violent video games, and I started to send them progressive material, magazines and Noam Chomsky DVDs and things like that, and you know, actually, and then it went well, and I got I was surprised it got through. The stuff did get through. Sometimes I'd get sort of a little bit angry notes, but I'd say 85% of the time they're gracious people. I actually got a couple little certificate of appreciation notes from the Marine Corps and stuff like that.
Wow,
and,
Preston. Because in my mind, I would have been hesitant to join it because I would have a defeatist attitude, I'm ashamed to say. I would have assumed that it would not have gotten through. The only things that would get through are war books and King James, and that's just about it. I mean, I'm thrilled to hear that some of these things got through. This is wonderful.
Yeah, and for the most part, there wasn't an issue, but it was always when I would send stuff, especially to Air Force people. They seemed to be the most closed-minded, for sure. And it was an Air Force officer who contacted the group who got me kicked off the site. Then I found another group that was doing the same thing called AnySoldier.com, and
yeah.
I was able to do the same stuff for a while. And then again, it was an Air Force officer. At one point, I was working with a guy in Canada who produces a DVD on peak oil issues in suburbia, and it's called The End of Suburbia. And someone from the Department of Homeland Security actually started skulking around and sending emails to the group, and they're like, what's this about kind of thing?
Oh,
it was an intimidation effort, you know? But
yeah.
They actually stood by me on that one, but eventually these officers put the kibosh on it, and so actually when I was hearing recently about Michael Reagan, I don't know if you heard about his scandal, but on the radio, he was on air one day. Did you hear about this?
I can't place it. There have been so much going on in my personal life regarding 24-hour server loads and weird. I've missed a lot over the past little while, so please tell me.
Well, recently, Michael Reagan, who's a radio host and son of Ronald Reagan, is it half-son or stepson or something? I don't know. I think he's a son. Who I've called, actually, once or twice, and you know, we have debates, and he's okay. I mean, disagree with him on everything, but, you know, he's usually not as, like, belligerent as, like, a Michael Savage, but he got on the radio about a week ago, and he said, there's this group out there, 9/11 Truth people, who are sending DVDs to the troops in Iraq and about how the attacks on the World Trade Center, it was an inside job, and they're undercutting the morale of the troops. And I say that these people who are sending these DVDs should be shot, and I'll pay for the bullet. They're committing treason against this country, and they should be shot. He repeated it. It wasn't like a one-off comment, slip of the tongue. He was pressing the point that these people should be killed for treason. And this is over 9/11 Truth stuff, which, you know, I think is challenging and stirs a lot of considerations that I think people should bear in mind.
Too many unanswered questions.
It struck home to me, you know, because I was sending out this other sort of material, and it's, in a way, that's what I was doing. I mean, if you mean undercutting morale, questioning these policies of our warlords, I was intentionally trying to do that, for sure, because I think it's a criminal war, and it should be undercut. But
well, way to go, Preston. You're walking the walk and talking the talk.
I try. I get a lot of support from people. And before I let you go, a couple movies I wanted to mention.
Oh, good. I have my pen.
But, and you might know this one. You had mentioned the suffragist movement earlier,
yeah.
I think. There's a movie mm-hmm. on right now that plays on Showtime or HBO from time to time. You may have seen it called Iron-Jawed Angels.
No, Iron-Jawed, iron like the metal?
Yep. Iron-Jawed Angels.
Angels.
Mm-hmm. And it's about the suffragist movement, and it stars Hilary Swank, actually.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's, I think the name comes from, something to do with, you know, when they were fasting and protesting, and I think during one of the fasts, you know, when one of them was put in prison for her protest, they tried to force feed her, and they, you know, it's kind of a brutal process they went through and try to shove food down her throat. And
wow.
So it's kind of a reference to that. And very powerful movie. And the one I just got, I haven't seen it yet, but I think you've seen it. It's that, you know, For the Bible Tells Me So.
Ah, yes. Disturbing flick.
I just got it from Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's, isn't it partially hopeful? I mean, some of their families coming to reconcile that their kids are gay or something like that?
Yeah, there are some uplifting parts. For the most part, though, it let's put it like this. For people who don't listen to Bob's Wednesday night camp meeting, it would do a world of good, because there are a lot of people who just have no clue, and this movie does a great job with that.
Okay.
Great book. I hope you enjoy it. I've seen a number along those lines, and I can't recall the scenes from Far the Bible Tells Me So off my head. I'm going to rewatch it.
But,
yeah, great. I remember it as being a good movie.
Well, I'll let you know what I think down the road after I see it here.
Okay. Wonderful.
Great.
And thank you, Preston. We always enjoy your calls. You're just a fountain of knowledge, and we appreciate you.
And I always learn so much from you. I appreciate the work you're doing, for sure.
Well, thank you, Preston.
We'll talk again soon.
Thank you, bye-bye. And good evening to you. Bye-bye. And that is our dear friend Preston, and from the Mile High City in Denver. We always enjoy hearing from Preston. He is a remarkable, insightful man, and you just never know where he's going to go during the course of one of his conversations. So, I admire Preston. We do. I'll tell you what, we had Hank Steinhauer scheduled at the gay bar across the street this evening, but his set runs a little bit longer than the time we have left, so we're going to move Hank to Friday night because we do have a guest tomorrow night who will be bringing along their own music tracks, and tomorrow night that would be Mr. John Hedges, a remarkable show. I hope that you catch that. So rather than cut Hank off on our field trip, gay bar across the street, what we're going to do is run one of our break tracks that we've been coming up with lately, and when we come back from the break track up, we have maybe one or two short stories, and we have a very special, yes we do, horn section this evening with a surprising person involved that I shall not name until we actually get into the show. So hang around, the evening is hardly what you would call done. Roll it, Agnes.
Do you still think that Katrina is punishment from God for a society that's becoming like Sodom and Gomorrah?
All hurricanes are acts of God because God controls the heavens. I believe that New Orleans had a level of sin that was offensive to God, and they are were recipients of the judgment of God for that. The newspaper carried the story in our local area that was not carried nationally, that there was to be a homosexual parade there on the Monday that the Katrina came. And the promise of that parade was that it was going to reach a level of sexuality never demonstrated before in any of the other gay pride parades. So I believe that the judgment of God is a very real thing. And I believe that the Hurricane Katrina was in fact the judgment of God against the city of New Orleans.
You think that the whole city was punished because of things like the forthcoming gay pride parade?
This is true. All of the city was punished because of the sin that happened there in that city.
Wow. I remember that song from back in the day, one of my all-time favorites, Color My Love by Fun Fun. That's Euro Disco. I recall our friend Alex Natipkin talked about that track. And if I'm not mistaken, I may be wrong about this, I think that particular remix was done by Mr. Bobby Vittoretti, but I'm not completely sure. That I don't know. We'll have to ask Bobby. This story came in, I'm going to do it briefly, this story came in just before this show started. It was posted in the chat room. And since we're talking about the contributions that our transsexual friends have made to the community over the years, and in fact, even being the attorney who brought the case before the Supreme Court in California with a transsexual, I should do this story. If you'd like to see the video, you can find it by Googling WMC-TV in Memphis, Tennessee, Channel 5, that's WMC, you can see the video. It's disturbing, I'll tell you that. It was a video that was recorded February the 12th, and a transsexual, Dwana Johnson's in the booking room at the Criminal Justice Center after being arrested for prostitution. There's so many people who say, yeah, the transsexuals are all prostitutes. Well, yes, some of them do work in the sexual services industry. It's damn hard to get a job these days without Employment Discrimination Act. Damn hard to get a job if you don't fill the gender roles. In any case, the tape clearly shows a Memphis police officer walk over to Johnson and hit her several times in the face. He had a handcuff wrapped around his fist so that he was hitting her with the chains and the cuff of the handcuff. Dwana says he was trying to get me to come over there to do fingerprints, and the officer was telling him, come over here, faggot, and let me get your fingerprints. Come over here, faggot. Well, this particular faggot, who is a transsexual, said, no, that's not the name my mother gave me. She did not name me faggot or he, she. The police officer got so upset that he went over and literally beat the hell out of her. He said, I'm giving you one more chance, and she didn't get up, and he caused many lacerations and cuts on her face. The tape actually shows another police officer holding Johnson's shoulders as she tries to protect herself. She said she was very, very afraid. A nurse was called down, and the nurse walked by her while she was maced also and left on the floor rocking back and forth in pain. A nurse came down from medical and walked right past her while she was begging for help and went over to treat the minor scuff on the police officer's hand from beating her with handcuffs. The video has been reviewed by both the FBI and the district attorney's office, and district attorney's office later dropped all the charges against Johnson for prostitution and the whole bit, and the FBI is investigating into civil rights violations. Meanwhile, the police department confirmed to Action News 5 that the officer holding Johnson was on probation and has been fired. The officer threw the punches is currently on non-enforcement status pending an administrative hearing. The Memphis Police Department released a standard vanilla statement saying to the effect, the Memphis Police Department does not condone or any sort of misconduct of the police officers, etc., etc. So I'm just saying that it doesn't matter to me if you're hauled in for first-degree murder or prostitution, you still have the right to be called by your name. The police officers had no business calling her faggot and he-she, and she did the right thing, and she was very brave. She knew she was in danger. She was very brave to resist going over to him and insist that he use her name, and she was very brave. She's braver than I would have been under those circumstances, and he beat her horribly. And again, this is in Memphis, Tennessee. You can go to News Channel 5, News 5, WMC-TV, and that's the story for being our transsexual brothers and sisters. I want to tell you that, in fact, there is a horn section this evening. The horn section is a round table or square table or triangular table of various horn hosts. Tonight we have myself and Mr. John Fox, and a surprise. I won't tell you. You'll just have to stick around and see. That starts in just a few minutes at 11 p.m. Eastern Time. And at 12 p.m., midnight, we'll have Mr. John Fox broadcasting from Australia with his show All Fox Stuff. So in closing, here's Cynthia Manley reminding you, too.